Bob Marshall with the International Connection. You know, I was in Los Angeles recently, and I was walking around, and I thought, if I don't interview Mr. Frank Zappa, then surely I'll still come out. Dialogue. Can you believe it? 3 hours right here on CKLN.
In the 80s. I don't mind, Dexter. Get back on the Phoenix Picket where you belong. Get the damn pipe out of your mouth. Your history, you're gone. Oliver North, no secret government for you, buddy. You're over. You're through. Bill Casey, you're dead.
Frank Zappa, starting Sunday at 10 o'clock, December 18th, continuing through January 1st, and completing on January 15th on CKLN.
Okay. All right?
Yeah, we're on.
Yeah, that's Sunday morning at 10 o'clock, December 18th, January 1st, and January 15th. We'll have... the result of Bob Marshall's encounter with Frank Zappa. I'm going to explain further about that interview and how Bob channeled my work and the effect on Frank. We have some direct evidence of that.
First of all, why don't we introduce ourselves?
Well, you're Mike.
I'm Mike. And you're?
Bob Dobbs. I EPOP.
We're here every other week at 12 o'clock on Wednesdays.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a very important time.
It's no time to sleep.
Let's play the effect of my work on the listeners, the subgeniuses.
Disciple one to Guru one. Disciple one to Guru one. Come in, Guru. Can you hear me? I have something to report now. The new initiate, Seamus McAtee, he was up for the 2-week intensive. He was exposed to Bob Knowledge for an almost continuous period of 2 weeks, and he made remarkable progress. It's a new kind of experiment, the kind of which we've never seen before in this electronic church. I might like to add that the kind of progress we witnessed in the Mike Dyer phenomenon took place over a year. That's the expense of exposure. The intensive was very, very effective. We saw all kinds of process pattern recognition taking place, plus there was content, and the user is now content and spreading the dogma. However, must report that there is one matter which the disciple was not able to come fully to grips with, and that is his question as to what is, according to Bob Knobs, the conspiracy behind the conspiracy. What Bob Knobs, on CKLN, gives us process pattern recognition, he gives us the files, he gives us a lot, but where does this take us? How does this help to get the underfinanced subgenius through these final dark days and out the other end? So we're looking for the plan. I can understand that maybe it cannot be released until after November 8th, but I believe that these disciples will be looking for the completed intensive. Over and out.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was an example of the effect of my work here on CKLN with the help of Mike. Mike is the subject of the extensive intensive, and what was that guy's name? Seamus McAtee, the subject of the intensive.
His voice was vaguely familiar, actually.
I don't know who that is. That was a subgenius, though. He communicates regularly on my home office headquarters machine. And he's just reported on an intensive carried out with a new subgenius candidate while I was away. Now, it brings us into the next topic. While I was away, certain things happened that could prove Bob's influence on various holy offices and a reciprocal relationship in return. But Frank Zappa was on a big talk show in California, goes over 32 states, AM station. On October 30th, a week after he met with me, and met with Bob Marshall. Right. Not me, but Bob was channeling my work. And right away, Frank went public with the information I gave him. And you've got that next little segment set up. This will lead into the next topic, which will answer that subgenius's question, what is the conspiracy behind the conspiracy? Many topics are surfacing the past week, but this is another instance of Bob knowledge being communicated by the Frank Zappa Holy Office as soon as he got it.
The book you were referencing during the break was a book called Higher Form of Killing.
A Higher Form of Killing, yes. This was given to me this week, and in the last chapter of the book, there's something in there that I found very amazing, and I'm going to do some further research on it. There is testimony in the book extracted from government records, from the congressional record, of scientists going to the Appropriations Committee in 1965 and requesting money to develop a virus that attacks the immune system. Now think about this. Now what I am going to do is see if I can obtain the complete record of that hearing. I want to find out which senators were on that committee, whether or not the money was appropriated. If it was appropriated, who got the money, and what did they do with it? Did somebody build a disease that attacks the immune system? And did some U.S. congressman say, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's build that. Because the discussion was about creating ethnically specific chemical weapons. The idea that you could kill certain people of certain ethnic groups because of certain special features of their ethnic makeup. It states in there that Cherokee Indians, all 99% of them have type O blood. So that would be a tag that you could use to, if you wanted to do away with Cherokee Indians, you could tag your bug to this particular fact. The other way that you could look at it, this isn't stated in the book, but it's something that I came up with independently. If you wanted to create genetically specific weapons, there are diseases which affect only certain people. For example, sickle cell anemia is not something that Irish people get.
Yeah.
And so a person who was an evil scientist could think about building a disease that would look for people who are susceptible to sickle cell anemia and then load in the disease on that track. Same thing with Tay-Sachs disease.
Which is?
This is a disease that certain Jews get. And
what about the AIDS disease? Is the AIDS disease, from your perspective, primarily a gay disease?
No, it is not a gay disease. The AIDS disease, as far as I'm concerned, is something that was created in a laboratory. There is no way that I will be convinced that it came from a green monkey. The green monkey story, as told to us by Dr. Koop, and this was on an HBO special where Dr. Koop answers questions about AIDS. I mean, I was rolling on the floor with this. The story goes that after he had told everybody that AIDS was a sexually transmitted disease and that we shouldn't be promiscuous and thereby save our lives, he said that the disease came from a green monkey in Africa. Now, how do you coordinate that with a sexually transmitted disease? Well, here's how he got around it. He said, perhaps the hunter, the native hunter, was going to eat the monkey. And while he was skinning the monkey, he cut himself when he was taking the fur off of the monkey. Now, people, if you believe that, then write in the Easter Bunny on your ballot on Election Day. I mean, this is, it's fantasy land.
But you've got a lot of young people, you've got a lot of elderly people, you've got people that are frightened of this AIDS epidemic, feeling that maybe the best policy is to really know somebody real well. In other words, a monogamous relationship being the way to go.
Well, I think monogamous relationships are fine. I also think that sex is fine. However, you decide to do it so long as what you do doesn't harm your partner or anybody else in the vicinity. You know, the whole idea of using a disease to promote Puritan morality is reprehensible, and that's what's been done with it.
Here is Gary in Hollyweird.
Yes,
hello, Gary.
Hi, Gary.
Okay, that was Frank using Bob knowledge channeled through Bob Marshall immediately, getting it out there.
When was that tape?
That was Saturday night, October 29th, going into Sunday morning, the 30th.
So that's why you were down there?
Yeah, like, yeah. Well, I moved out of the California area. I was in Washington, but Frank had been given the information just before I left. All right, so now, that's a sample of dialogue and the work of Bob and why I'm an important person here in Toronto, right? And why Toronto is fortunate to have my church here on this station. I think dealing with the question that the subgenius out there asked, what is the conspiracy behind the conspiracy? This can be answered by another important event that happened this past week. On November 22nd, a memo was sent directly to Bob from the Marshall McLuhan Holy Office. So that memo was the publication of his final manuscript, The Laws of Media, The New Science. And this is a new science. Now, the important point to know here, the esoteric symbology of it, is that this book finally got released in 1988. The last major work put out by Marshall McLuhan, called Take Today, The Executive's Dropout, happened in 1972. Now, this book comes out late 88 into 89, all right? That is 17 years from 1972. Now, a precursor to Marshall, whose work Marshall continued, was James Joyce. His second last work came out in 1922, and then 17 years later, his final masterpiece, Finnegan's Wake, came out. The first was Ulysses in 1922, then Finnegan's Wake, 17 years later, came out in 1979. Now, the other big influence in Marshall McLuhan was Wyndham Lewis. And Wyndham Lewis affected Marshall personally when he was at Cambridge in England in 1935. That's when he first came across Wyndham Lewis's work. 1935. Now, that's 53 years till 1988, right? But it was in 1953, under the influence of Wyndham Lewis, that Marshall McLuhan started his ongoing seminar called the Center for Culture and Technology. So you see, in Wyndham Lewis's situation, you have a 53-year interval between Marshall's first acquaintance with his work till the culmination of his work, and as a result of the seminal influence of Wyndham Lewis coming out in 1988-89 period, 53 years later. Yet it was 1953, that Marshall began his work. All right? Parallel that. That's the Wyndham Lewis parallel. And along with Joyce, you have the number 17 as an interesting number between the publication of Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake and Take Today by Marshall, and 17 years later, the 17th year anyways, 1988-89, the last masterpiece by Marshall, Laws of Media. This kind of numerology is important in understanding the work of Bob. And if you want to know why the number 17 is important, read the book, The Holy Blood and the Holy Grail. You know that book? You've seen that? The Holy Blood, the Holy Grail? You'll see the use of the number 17 through that often. That is the key number by the esoteric Freemasons who run Europe. That's the key interval they use, number 17. So it's no accident that James Joyce and Marshall are using that number too. Now, the question is, what is the laws of media about? This new science explains metaphor in the most complete perceptual format that's ever been done by man, as far as you know about him. There were some instances way back, pre-recorded, pre-history, which I was part of, which explained the metaphor as a perceptual apparatus. But that is not known by the Pinks, and not even by the subgenius. But in our known record, set up and propped up by the Pinks, this is the first time metaphor has been explained. Now, metaphor is a ratio. A is to B as C is to D. It's a ratio of two. It's a proportion between two ratios. So we can call one ratio a figure in relation to a ground. The other ratio is a figure in relation to a ground. So you have two figures and two grounds. So the question by our subgenius is, what is the conspiracy behind the conspiracy? Well, the essence of that is metaphor. In other words, the conspiracy behind the conspiracy is a relationship, a ratio of proportions. So you have the top-down conspiracy, a figure-ground relationship, and then you have the bottom-up conspiracy, a figure-ground relationship, but the two interrelate as a metaphor, and that metaphor is a live, active, organic thing. Now, the best way to analyze and visual, well, we'll just use the word analyze. We'll get away with that for a minute. To analyze metaphor, you use the structure of the tetrad, and that is the basic thing explained in Marsh McLuhan's book, Memo to Bob, Laws of Media. An example of a tetrad is four-part structure where you take any medium, you ask, what does it enhance? Then you ask, what does it obsolesce? What does it retrieve? And what does it flip into? A simple, this would be an appropriate one to analyze. Read what it says you enhance when you use the medium of the radio, which we're using now. You enhance
access to entire planet. Everybody, everywhere.
Everybody is everywhere. It obsolesces
wires and connections and physical bodies.
We've pointed that out much, yes. The discarnate state. It retrieves
tribal ecological environment, trauma, paranoia.
Yeah, and it flips into
global village theater.
Now, that's the first time in Marshall's works, in his books, where global village theater is put together. I've always maintained that global village was an effect of the telegraph, early radio, but the theater is flipping radio into a new form, an opposite form, that's TV and satellite conditions, which turns the global village into art form.
Mm-hmm.
So it's theatrical. Radio, under Hitler conditions, is global village, but since 1957, it's a global village theater. So that is the real phrase that Marsh McLuhan should be famous for, global village theater, not just global village.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a sample of using the tetrad on an environment, a figure-ground relationship. What is the figure of radio and the effects of its services and disservices on its users? Well, this tetrad lays it out. I think to make this relevant to our listeners, let's do a tetrad on Bob. Let's talk about what does Bob Dobbs, me, what do I enhance, what do I obsolesce, what do I retrieve, which was obsolesce before, and what do I flip into and push too far? Right, so we can have input from callers, or we could have Mike attempt to begin. What do you think I enhance?
Well, you utilize what you refer to as Bob knowledge. Now,
yeah, but what's that?
Well, that's what many of us have yet to figure out. So
I enhance confusion, maybe. No, that's too one-sided, right?
Yeah,
you couldn't say that.
Yeah.
I enhance something that seems to be worthwhile, but not immediately apparent.
Mm-hmm. You utilize the electric environment.
Right, so I enhance awareness of the electric environment.
Yeah, but, you know, I also wonder how many people we reach. And so who are you enhancing if no one is listening?
But under radio conditions, everybody is everywhere. You can be actively on the planet, but you are discarnate whether you're using the radio or not.
Mm-hmm.
We're all inside the satellite environment, so we are everywhere. And we're in touch with everybody whether we like it or not. So we are communicating to everybody on the planet.
Yeah.
Whether they hear us or not, we are having a tactile pressure on them, and they are reciprocating with a pressure on us. That's the fun of being on the radio.
You are providing them
an awareness
access,
of that.
But also access to Bob.
Right.
At all levels.
In other words, it didn't matter where I showed up on the electric environment, but I had to get on the electric environment, mm-hmm. and the only place I could do it would be CKLN.
Yeah.
And then that made me accessible to everybody.
So it just happens. It happens to be radio. It could be another, you know, another source, but in this case, it's radio. Could it be television?
I don't think television would be appropriate right
mm-hmm.
now.
Mm-hmm.
It had to be radio at
yeah.
this point in the 80s as a counter environment to the TV age. Oh, they disconnected.
Yeah, well, yeah.
We did have a call. Call back.
Yeah, we are taking calls. If you have some thoughts on this, 595-1655.
I don't think
let's keep it clean.
Yeah, I don't think I would obsolesce. I wouldn't want to be down as obsolescing phone calls.
Yeah.
Right.
No.
So what do you think I obsolesce?
When you use the term obsolesce.
What do I push aside? Oh, here it is, another question.
Well, no, I just pick it up here.
Yeah.
Hi, CKLM.
Hi, different caller, but I was wondering, talking about metaphors earlier on, Bob, I was wondering the movie They Live, just saw tonight, how could They Live be a metaphor for Bob's campaign?
That's a good question. They Live is a slow build-up to a fantastic, that movie called They Live, is a very good slow, casual build-up to a great punchline. And the punchline of that movie, I hope I'm not giving away the surprise ending, is the turning off the electric environment. Would you agree?
That definitely turn off the electric environment. But what happens in the movie, they don't turn it off, but they do something to the environment that makes everyone see the hidden ground that they hadn't seen before.
That's right. Well, it does get, remember, the hero, the subgenius, does blow out the system so that the...
He thinks he's turning the environment off, but what he does is he changes the environment so people perceive it differently. He offers a new form of pattern recognition through the eye, which they were stressing the whole time, that the eye was the key to it.
Yeah, you're right, with the glasses metaphor all the way through it, the sunglasses.
That's right.
And now, in other words, the electric environment is essentially an acoustic space, so the anti-environment would be visual space.
Right.
Right, so the eye is, but it is key to...
Everyone's supposed to watch the TV. The TV is the figure. The ground is the satellite transmitter, which no one can see. It's invisible, and it's hypnotizing everyone.
Yeah, there is a bit of content emphasis there, but it's good as a metaphor to show how people are conditioned by an invisible environment.
Right.
But the fact is that, you're right, he doesn't turn off all the electric environment, but he turns off the key hidden environment, which is the satellite environment, that hypnotic factor. And today the satellite environment is largely invisible. It was through the 60s and 70s, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they still had the TVs functioning. So it's accurate showing the satellite environment, especially as the controllers were people from another solar system.
Right.
So it had the extraterrestrial dimension. And that certainly reflects the belief of Bob and what he talks about in the with the X's coming. Now, the X's, this movie says that the X's are already here, right?
Right.
And that's what I say in my thing, that the X's are already here.
You know what the other question is the question of when did the aliens take over?
Yeah.
And notice that what the aliens promote is greed and gain. And so I wonder if the aliens took over in 1963.
Well, you know, I say the aliens took over, you know, centuries ago.
Right.
And that movie leaves that open. I say that the counter aliens, the X's, arrive in 88. They've landed only recently.
Right.
So we're talking about two different alien structures.
Right.
So I don't think it's that important that determine which one lands when or when they affect each other. The important thing is that the hidden technological ground is what is used to hypnotize everybody. And when that's cut off by the hero,
right,
suddenly you could tell the pinks from the subgeniuses.
And the pinks are scared badly.
They're scared badly.
Oh, at the very end, oh boy, they're like, oh, the Emperor has no clothes, and there's nothing we can do to convince people that that's the truth.
Yeah, now that's...
Or no, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, now that's when everybody could see the obvious. Pattern recognition was universal. And that's what Bob is, a universal pattern recognition. Now the movie leaves...
That saves people in the end. That was the only thing that could save the people. They had to, because no one would believe it until they could see it.
Until
the only way that people could be mobilized into taking any concrete action was first to have what they were taking concrete action against revealed. And it was invisible to them the whole time.
So the hero achieved
something incredible. So in that sense, it's a metaphor for Bob's, but it's also different to Bob's because Bob released the files and a lot of people didn't care.
Yeah, but the files were just going through the motions because up till the time Bob was in control, we were robots.
Right. So this is a slow undoing process, unlike in the film that was an instantaneous flash of new pattern recognition.
Well, it was an encapsulation of what happened earlier this year. And I think the point is that the guy unites everybody in seeing what's happening by percept, by direct sensory awareness of the environment that was hidden. He makes what was ground figure. You can see
Yes. Yeah, ground becomes figure. Absolutely. So there's a ground figure interplay.
Yeah, now what the movie doesn't carry on with is what to do. It leaves that situation in a situation of suspense about what are the subgenies going to do when they see the pinks all around them so obviously.
Yeah,
and
that's a big topic.
And I think that's why I'm here on the radio, is that I'm the part after the movie.
All right.
The process of dealing with the fact we can see it. I mean, once I'm on the air, the pinks and services and the pinks and subgenies know who each other is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what that movie dramatized. So Bob is a percept, which is a metaphor, a live, active interplay between figure and ground.
And they live, John Carpenter's film, no matter what they say in Metropolis magazine or now gave it a half-decent review. It's a must-see. It's a brilliant metaphor. And it definitely can be used as a metaphor for Bob's campaign.
Yeah, you're right. And the movie is technically maybe inferior, but the concept overwhelms because it
absolutely
points out percept.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Subgenie.
Hey.
Is that, thank you, caller.
Thank you.
Okay, praise Bob.
Praise Bob.
Well, okay, another satisfied customer, I think, Bob.
Yeah, that was the... Have you seen that movie?
No, I haven't.
Recommend it.
Mm-hmm.
What else did I want to...
I wanted to ask you about this past week's earthquake, and I know you were responsible for it. I had this feeling you were responsible.
Oh, I forgot. I'm glad you brought that
up. Yeah, and I wanted to ask about the circumstances surrounding the earthquake.
That was part of the fact that I got the memo from the Marshall McLuhan Holy Office on November 22nd. We all know the importance of the number 22. 3 days later, November 25th, I'm in the Carlton Cineplex watching my mirror image, Tom Waits. You know, his movie?
Yeah.
Many people mistake me for Tom Waits. I look like him in certain times, especially on Fridays when I haven't shaved.
This is the great loss with the radio environment as opposed to the television. People don't get to see you unless they come down.
And they can. Yeah, I do. I've been mistaken many times. And so I'm watching a movie about my mirror self. The guy is dancing. He's moving. He's singing the way I would sing.
Mm-hmm.
If I was given that kind of movie video improv metaphor approach. The point is that, Ken, you want to take that phone there?
Well, we'll pick it up.
We're going to pick up that phone, buddy. Keep ringing. Just to finish this thought. The point is, there I'm watching a mirror image of myself in movie conditions from 5 o'clock till 6:45. And I'm also in the middle of digesting Marshall McLuhan's memo. I walk out of the theater, and I start drifting down Young Street, and the earthquake happens.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's because of the mirror effect of me seeing myself in movie form in the Carlton Cinema, which is a nice place to watch a movie.
Yeah.
So that's why the movie, the earthquake happened. And then I finished reading the Marshall McLuhan memo, Laws of Media, November 29th, which 2/9 is 11, November's 11 month, that's 11/11. So much resonance there.
Okay, no, you don't have to pick that up. We just hung up.
Did I disconnect him?
Yeah, sorry. Well, he'll call right back.
Yeah, call right back. We disconnect you.
We're going over a little tonight, but that's okay. We like to.
We need to go over. Oh, there he is. Okay, put him on.
We'll pick it up. Hi, CKLM.
How's it going?
Good, thanks.
Good. What does Bob enhance? Bob enhances my slack, my gaining of complete and total slack, and regaining it from the people who stole it from me over the years.
That's a correct statement. I think we could make that a scientific... We could hold a press conference, you and I, tomorrow and make that a scientific statement, you know.
It really provides me a meaning for my existence and a certain respect, I suppose, in order to survive the day-to-day tribulations of having to deal with pinks.
So
and,
that's what I obsolesce, then, the
exactly.
Tribulations. What do I retrieve? I mean, am I retrieving slack? I enhance slack, but what do I retrieve that was obsolete a long time ago?
What do you retrieve?
Yeah.
Well, there is nothing to retrieve except the slack itself, because everything is slack in the truest sense of the word. So what is there possibly to retrieve?
Very good question. Very good answer. Now, that means when pushed to extreme, I flip into more slack.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the fact is, it's necessary not to become one with the slack, but in order to become not two with the slack, to not see the slack outside of yourself, but to see yourself as total slack.
You should be a professional subgenius, buddy.
I think that's what I do for a living, as a matter of fact.
Well, listen, if you have anything else to talk about, or why don't you come down and see Bob?
I'm seeing Bob right at the present time, because I'm sitting here watching something on television, and what could be more Bob
That's right.
In a postmodern sense, if you will.
Well, in Understanding Media by McLuhan, he defines TV as the timid giant. That's definitely what I am, the timid giant.
Exactly.
Well, you're pretty perceptive. Keep up the good work. And we welcome any more input in the future.
We try our best.
Good. Thanks for calling us.
Good night.
Well, another person. I think, Bob, what that person was talking about was the phenomenon known as hyper-slack, where you go beyond slack and you go into hyper-slack. And what else? He mentioned something else I wanted to follow through on.
That it gives him a break. Well, he does have the tribulation every day. I mean, it doesn't seem as slack and last forever. It comes to him when he gets back home. When he's watching TV or listening on the radio, he has that electric condition again. Mm-hmm. He's discarnate.
Mm-hmm.
He's forced to use his body, and I guess that's the slackless state during the day.
Yeah.
Or whenever he works. We have another one. Let's take
this. Okay, let's go to the phones. Hi, CKLM.
Hi.
Hi. Do you have a question for Bob?
Yeah. I was just with the question that you posed earlier. I was saying I had recently, I think, heard whoever it is. But I think what you're doing is you're giving a bit out, but I'm not too sure necessarily. Well, at least for me, it's not too clear. Of course, I don't think it would be.
So you say I'm giving out, but I'm not taking in?
No. What I'm saying is that from what you're giving out, at least for me, it's not clear to give back anyway.
Right, to reciprocate back to me.
Yeah.
Well, that isn't a desirable condition to be in, because we don't know until you know whether you should directly give something back to me.
Yeah.
Because that would be quite an effect on you. I mean, if I see myself in a movie and I cause an earthquake, then just think of what happens to other subgeniuses when they meet me, which is the basic essence of yourself.
Yeah.
So if you don't know how to reciprocate to me, that's okay. It'll take a while, but I guarantee you will know someday, and you will reciprocate with me.
Yeah, well, I'm getting what you're saying. Most of it is just that with all the terms that you're using and whatnot.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point, is that the terms aren't important. I do try to communicate beyond language. Mike, you want to say something there? Oh, okay. No, the point is the language is not important, because that's just one medium, the verbal medium. I communicate in post-verbal and pre-verbal media, and you are picking up on that.
Yeah.
If you're not too skilled on the terms, don't worry about it. That's not even important.
Yeah, because like I've been jotting down with a few of the stuff that you've been using as reference. I don't know if it's important or not, but, well, just basically that I think what you're saying is pretty hip.
Yeah, that's right. It is hip. There's no doubt about that. And but keep jotting it down and just put it aside. And as Captain Beefheart said, he recommended to listen to his music while you're vacuuming or doing dishes. That's the jotting. What you're jotting down is a parallel activity, but it's not major importance. But keep doing it, because it'll retrieve and be important at some point when you use your eyes and look at those notes.
Yeah. Like, I'm trying to be a receptacle, but not too much.
Well, you're a very clever person.
Well, all right. Well, thank you.
Okay, thanks for calling, listener.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, this is quite exciting, Bob. We've never had such a really open, receptive audience as we have tonight. Often we have to plead for calls, or we have friends call, my personal friends, who phone out of sympathy for me.
But these are, as we go further into the final turn, and I'd like to say that we are going around the final turn. The problem is that we've gone off the track.
Yeah. What this listener has called about, again, is a point that's come up in the past. I remember a few weeks ago. We'll get to the phones.
We'll get you, buddy.
Our operator's just very busy right now. Where I brought up the point, and I said it sort of tongue-in-cheek, but I think maybe it's true, that sometimes we alienate our listeners, our first-time listeners especially, who come to this and they're feeling lost. They don't know how they can, integrate themselves into the church community, and so I think there is that sense of, searching, wanting to embrace it all at once. You really can't. That other caller on your recorded answering machine referred to my transformation, which took a long time, and I was very patient and willing, and I still have a long way to go, and you have to acknowledge that. I still don't understand a lot of what you say, but I nod my head knowingly like a little dog. And
you know you can understand.
Yes, I know that, and I think that's very important. So just to follow through on that, listener, so let's go back to the phone. Hi, CKLN.
You're on.
No, it's not.
Oh, you disconnected. That one's
Tracy Kellen? Tracy Kellen. Okay, we're good.
Let's
all
pick
right.
this up. See what happens.
We can put it on. That's fine. Okay. All anyways, right. Yeah, we'll come back. Let's just take one more call, I think, because
we couldn't get you for time. Some reason. Call back if you were the
one. Okay, just one more call, Bob.
We're yeah, one more, yeah.
We're a few gone over, and then we'll play our theme music to go out.
But I've always said, when you brought up the point of alienating audiences, that the proper subgenius growth is 1.3. You don't want to double your figures or triple immediately. You have to only have 1/3% growth every time. Let's try this again. We have another caller.
I see Kalen.
Bob, I was wondering if you might be frank with us this evening and talk a little bit, if you would, about the dangers of Bob and the Church of the Subgenius.
Well, there are many dangers. Which ones do you want me to elucidate some new dangers, or what?
Well, no, I do have one particular one in mind. There's the danger of inoculating churches, or pardon me, subgeniuses, and possibly pinks as well, against the very message that's being preached by the Church of the Subgenius. And I was wondering if you could comment on that possible effect.
Are you talking? You're not talking about the Church of the Subgenius put out by Reverend Stang in the book, are you?
Well, no, I'm just talking about the relationship between the ideas that you espouse and the subgenius ideas as well.
Well, okay, the subgenius ideas, you mean the ones that have been put out in the bookstores?
Yeah.
Right, okay, so we have to, you're saying the problem of relating my claims with the claims of that book.
Well, yeah, and also just the problem of inoculating people against the idea. See, if they get a little bit of the idea, but not the entire idea at once, they may be less receptive later to the whole.
Yes, but since I'm the chairman of the Secret Council 10, I'm pretty well in a responsible, charge-filled position for many thousands of years to come, so we do have a lot of time for people to see and recover their awareness of what we're originally trying to do.
So the continuity will take care of these problems.
That's right. There's no way that my work is going to be stopped, so we expect, as a matter of fact, the book talks about there should be rebellion against my work. There should be counter-churches, misinformed churches set up. So we expect reactions that are erroneous because they're necessary to have as a counter-environment to keep my work continuing.
But you're assuming that they're erroneous.
That's right. We won't know until the end time. That's what makes me Bob and you're not, because I have full confidence in what I'm doing, right? I'm not saying that as an egomaniac. It's just a fact that gives me the confidence to do it. But I acknowledge that things have to unfold at their own rate and own pace, and therefore a lot of confusion will happen. But I accept that responsibility, and it is dangerous for me only up to a point. I mean, I cannot be harmed anymore.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your honesty.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks for your call. Bye.
Well,
ooh, this is exhilarating. I really get off on this sort of stuff, Bob. This is real radio.
Yeah. This is community radio.
Let's stop it there, I think, for tonight. And perhaps you're going to be around, aren't you, till the end of the show?
Yeah, if anybody wants to call on the
other line. Yeah, 595-1478, just because it's a better line to talk on while we're here.
Yeah.
So thanks for coming down again this week. And
thank you for having me, Mike.
Yeah,
and
it's always a pleasure.
That last question was very important. We're always trying to explain the difference between Stang and me. And I did visit Reverend Stang, the author of that book, earlier, when was it, October 28th, about, and he agreed in presence, in my presence, in Connie's presence there in Dallas, that I was the real Bob. He was corrected. He said he realizes that the Bob that's pictured in all the decals and book covers around the world is not the way Bob looks anymore. If you want to have an approximation, looks like Tom Waits.
Yes.
The thing is that he admitted that, yes, I was Bob, and he broadcast that fact on the air. So there's been repentance of the church, and that is part of the shift that's happened since the X's have landed earlier this year. So we do have some earthquakes on all levels happening, and a lot more confusion is going to happen. The 90s will be a time of incredible confusion. As a matter of fact, if you're a real subgenius, you're going to really dig the confusion, because it'll give you more opportunities.
And as one of our, you sounded like a young caller said, you know, what's happening now is very hip. And I think that's an appropriate word as well.
Yeah, and that's not plastic surgery.
No, we're talking hip.
Warm flesh.
My name is Michael Dyer. You're listening to CKLN FM 88.1. We're wrapping up this segment of The Church of the Subgenius with Bob Dobbs. He'll be back in 2 weeks.
Yeah, and I've been impressed with the church response. And
yeah, it's been
fantastic.
Great. So let's do this again, shall we?
Yeah, we'll open up the phones when we can.
Okay, let's go to our theme music, Bob.
Good night.
The worst date we've ever had.
Please go.
They can't maintain the linearity. They can't be done on radio.
Vous écoutez CKLN FM 88.1 Toronto.